Amber Concerts and Neptune Records present a Southern Lord Recordings tour featuring Obliterations. With openers, Baptists, and Torch Runners. This Saturday, October 25th, at the Biltmore Cabaret. Door 7 p.m., show 8 p.m., and 11 p.m. Obliterations, composed of current and ex-members of Black Mountain, Savior, and Nighthorse, are on tour to support their debut full-length release, Poison Everything. Tickets are $13, available online at ticketweb.ca, also available in person at Red Cat Records, Zulu Records, Neptune Records, and Scrape Records. Discorder leaps into October with an issue featuring Johnny DeCourcy, Prairie Cat, Les Chaussettes, Ryan Bell, Sam Tudor, and more. Grab a copy around town or check it out online at discorder.ca. Make sure you catch a special staff sound off where Discorder writers reveal which artists they'd most like to be haunted by. And Discorder would like to extend a special thank you to this month's advertisers, Broken Pencil Magazine, LiveBand.com, Print Print, Rickshaw Theater, Sad Mag, SFU Woodward's Cultural Programs, The Cinematheque, The Fox Cabaret, Vancouver International Film Festival, Vancouver New Music, and Vinyl Records.
Wednesday mornings on CITR from 8 to 10 a.m., it's the Suburban Jungle Show with your radio host, DJ Jack Velvet. Thrills, chills, excitement, and music. That's the Suburban Jungle Show, Wednesday mornings from 8 to 10 on 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also catch this show, streaming and podcast, at www.jackvelvet.net. Don't miss the Suburban Jungle Show. Wednesdays, 8 to 10, 101.9 FM, CITR.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Today is Friday, the 24th of October. I'm Rohit Joseph.
And I'm Emily Blake. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia, to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It's 5:06 and time for a full hour of independent campus, local, and international news. Today's top stories and segments are our science and technology correspondent Marco's discussion of this week's top science findings.
We also have a quick public service announcement about Food for Fines, a food drive being sponsored by the UBC Libraries and the AMS Food Bank, as well as a tribute to the shootings in Ottawa on Wednesday.
Later in the program, News correspondent Emily Blake's report on the upcoming municipal election, as well as an interview with Nicole Markwick, a grad student at UBC's School of Population and Public Health, about the ongoing crisis in West Africa.
We also have part two of our coverage of UBC's proposed tuition and residence fee increases. But first, some headlines for today. In campus news, UBC receives $11.6 million grant for new Canada Research Chairs. Yesterday, the Canada Research Chair Program ordered UBC $11.6 million, enough to fund 16 chair positions. Nationally, 137 chairholder positions were created across 37 post-secondary institutions, receiving $118 million of federal funds. Minister of State Science and Technology Ed Holder reiterated that, quote, "Our government is committed to science, technology, and innovation to improve our quality of life and create new jobs and opportunities for Canadians." With three renewals and 13 new appointments, UBC now has the second highest number of Canada Research Chairs in the country at 186. Vice President Research and International John Hepburn issued a statement saying, quote, "Our professors are making important discoveries that are invaluable to academia and to the world at large, so we're very grateful for the program's support."
The Dalai Lama visited UBC on this Wednesday, October 22nd. His Holiness came to UBC to lead a panel on the discussion on the importance of teaching empathy and compassion to young children and future generations. The Dalai Lama's arrival at UBC was met with many supporters and a handful of protesters. The ISC, which is made up of various Buddhists from around the world, held up signs that read, quote, "False Dalai Lama, give religious freedom." They demanded that the Dalai Lama oppose the ban on worship of the Dorje Shugden School of Buddhism. The protesters handed out brochures criticizing the Tibetan government to passersby. The Global Tibetan Volunteers for the Truth, or GTVFTT, made a statement in which they declared their opposition to the ISC. Quote, "We strongly condemn all the uncalled protests and unsubstantiated writings circulated by the Shugden followers," in a statement about the string of ISC protests. They also said, quote, "We request people around the world not to fall in their trap by listening to their unfounded allegations, which are full of lies and backed by Chinese government machinery."
In local news, a bulk fuel tanker has lost power and is drifting towards Haida Gwaii. According to the Globe and Mail, the Canadian Coast Guard received a call at 11 p.m. last night about the ship, which is carrying 450 tons of fuel. The tanker lost power, and the crew can no longer change its course. The tanker drifted within 14 kilometers of the coast and shows no signs of stopping. The dangerous cargo is cause for concern, as the ship is reportedly carrying 400 tons of bunker fuel and 50 tons of diesel fuel. The Council of the Haida Nation has declared a state of emergency, releasing a statement on their Facebook page, quote, "The Coast Guard is preparing for the worst, with the ship hitting ground in 3 to 4 hours. The Coast Guard has dispatched two tugboats from Alaska and Prince Rupert, but it is estimated that they will not arrive before the ship reaches Haida Gwaii. This is a breaking story, and we will be updating you as it develops."
In national news, the first Canadian casualty of the enterovirus D86 has been reported in Vancouver. The BC Center for Disease Control confirmed this morning that a man from the Lower Mainland passed away after contracting the enterovirus D68. The man in his 20s was admitted to the hospital earlier this week and did not show signs of paralysis or the neurological symptoms which can occur in some cases.
Those are your campus, local, national, and international headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
The Capital One Just for Laughs comedy tour returns with a stellar lineup of headliners, starring stand-up writer and person Dimitri Martin.
I'm standing right behind you.
Funny as Hell host John Doerr, Canadian Comedy Award winner Levi McDougall, and podcast superstar Todd Glass. The Capital One Just for Laughs comedy tour at the Orpheum on November 14th. Tickets on sale now at Ticketmaster. For details, check Metro News or go to hahaha.com/comedy tour.
And thank you for that. We're now back on News 101. Now we have Marco with his science and technology segment. Hello, Marco.
Welcome. As everybody knows, yesterday we saw a partial eclipse. At about 3 p.m. Pacific time, the moon covered, eventually, two-thirds of the sun as viewed from B.C. The eclipse lasted for about 2.5 hours, but get ready, next year in August we'll have a total eclipse, so the day sky will be dark. In environmental news, a researcher, Mark Cerezi, a professor of geology at the University of Boulder, Colorado, has made a startling discovery. The Antarctic ice sheets are at record low levels, the Arctic ice sheets keep melting and are at record low levels, but the Antarctic ice sheets are at record high levels. As you may recall, in 2013, the Russian ship MV Anderik Solatsky was trapped in ice and had to be rescued out of there. So generally, the global warming trend is that there is a general perception that all ice in the world is melting, but apparently this is not true. The Antarctic ice sheets are at record levels, and Tibet glaciers are also at record high levels. The Antarctic is, Professor Cerezi explains it this way. The Antarctic is thicker ice in the middle, and in the margins, it is thinner. So icebergs keep breaking off, and when they float around, they slow down the motion of the sea ice, which leads to a growth of sea ice. This year, Professor Cerezi measured the Antarctic ice sheet at 1.54 million square kilometers, greater than the 1980 to 2010 levels. In science news, a new circuit design could unlock the power of superconducting microchips. Researchers at MIT have come up with a superconducting chip with zero electrical resistance that is 5 to 100 times more energy efficient than traditional chips, faster and with greater processing power. Given the power consumption of massive data centers that power the internet's most popular site, this is a major breakthrough. This chip, called the Nano Cryotron, could replace Josephson Junction chips, which are harder to make, and use miniature circuits that make the results of their computations difficult to detect. The professor sees future applications in supercomputing and in quantum computing. The new chip, which has zero electrical resistance, means electrons can travel through the through the components completely unimpeded. In copper wire and all other chips, electrons hit atoms and heat up. In this chip, the chip is cooled down to extremely low temperatures, 16 degrees above below zero. So this damps the vibration of the atoms. The operating power of this chip is 1% of traditional chips, so it makes it more cost-effective to build single photon detectors, which are essential components of any quantum computing system. In other research news from Europe, the University of Bielefeld and Manchester in England and Zaragoza in Spain, scientists are the first ever to successfully reach temperatures below or close to absolute zero, which is minus 272 degrees Celsius. The researchers reached a low of 272.15 degrees Celsius using magnetic molecules and magnetic salts. Traditionally, scientists have used helium-3, but that is now really expensive and not ready available. Unless, of course, if you go to the surface of the moon, where there's thousands and thousands of years of supply. The molecules, or the magnetic ions, which are called gadolinium, are readily available, and they work this way. The magnetic salts in the molecules cool down when the external magnetic field generated by electromagnetic device reduces the electric current and the magnetic field in the current, so the paramagnetic salts cool down. This is a new breakthrough because it is readily available. And now, in our next headline from UBC, Fresh Food for Thought, Professor Ricky Yada, the new dean of the UBC Faculty of Land and Food Systems, recently commented on certain issues regarding food scientists. Professor Yada said, and quote, nutrition plays a vital role in everyone's life, so there's a big debate about the food we consume. Professor Yada commented on the following three topics. Opinion is divided over eating GMOs. Professor Yada said, currently there are no safety issues with GMOs, but the only thing is labeling is an issue. If you are afraid of GMOs, the professor said, stick with organic. The second thing, juicing is currently a trend. Is this healthy? Professor Yada said, antioxidants are important to help the body fight aging and disease. While store-bought juices are good, some antioxidants are lost through the process. The professor recommends eat fresh fruits and vegetables. The third thing, what's the biggest misconceptions about food scientists? The biggest one is what food scientists do. Professor Yada said food scientists actually develop products that show up on grocery shelves. The other misconception is about canned foods and the void of nutrition in them. Canned foods, and the professor said, are picked and canned at the height of the fruit and vegetables' freshness, so they can actually be quite good. Fresh fruit, which is transported, is sometimes heated, and a lot of the minerals and the nutrients are lost in the transportation process. This is Marco. You have been listening to CITR Science and Technology News.
Thank you, Marco. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments here on CITR 101.9 FM.
This is the sound of compost and recyclables going into the garbage. Garbage that ends up in the landfill creating greenhouse gases. This is the sound of a more sustainable campus. You can make a difference when you sort it out. Learn more at sustain.ubc.ca/sortitout.
Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at CITR.ca, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us. Up next, we have a quick public service announcement about Food for Fines, a food drive being sponsored by the UBC Libraries and the AMS Food Bank.
Hi, my name is Kirsty Hilberda, and I'm the coordinator of the AMS Food Bank.
And welcome to News 101. So what would you like to talk to us about today?
I am doing a fundraiser, the Food Bank is doing the fundraiser, with UBC Libraries. From October 20th to November 2nd, students can pay their library fees with non-perishable items in this contribution to the Food Bank. And each non-perishable item contributes $2 to library fines.
If students do want to start paying off their library fines, where can they go to drop off their non-perishable food items?
Any UBC library.
And how many items can students donate?
15, I suppose. it's a maximum of $30.
Where does the food and non-perishable goods, where does that go to?
Of everything collected, half of it goes to the Greater Vancouver Food Bank and half of it goes to us, and we're located here on campus. We're in the lower level of the sub in room 42U. We're an emergency food relief service, so any student is able to use us as long as they have a valid student ID, and our office hours are posted on our door and on our website. You can find it pretty easily by just Googling AMS Food Bank. And people can just drop in during our office hours if they have questions or want to use the service.
And how many students do you find end up using this service?
It depends on the time of year. We tend to have more at the end of the semester due to financial needs, but on average about 20 a week.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Up next, we have a tribute to Wednesday shootings in Ottawa, produced by news correspondent Konstantin Pradonovich. The piece was originally published online yesterday.
Okay. October 22nd, 2014 will be remembered as the day that Canada paused for a moment. The events on Parliament Hill yesterday put us at a standstill, glued us to TV screens and radios. They gripped us, and rightfully so. One day later, it still feels like a bad dream. The sound of gunshots ringing through our Parliament's center block still echo. The images of a soldier receiving CPR still float through our minds, and we sympathize with the city in lockdown. Perhaps it was enough to frighten us, to make us stop for a moment. But one lone gunman looking to make a point will not break our resolve, nor should we give him that much credit. What might break us is what comes next. Over the next few weeks, there will be fingers pointed, questions of security raised, partisan squabbling, and plenty of blame. Instead, we should approach this as an opportunity to reevaluate. Reevaluate the way we see ourselves domestically, as some peaceable kingdom. We often expect our multiculturalism and openness to shield us, to act as a safeguard from these sorts of events. We don't acknowledge our own systemic flaws, which may contribute to them. Homegrown terrorism is, after all, homegrown. And I hope that in our reflection, we will take time to acknowledge our place in this tragedy. For as long as we see ourselves just as victims of some unstoppable act of evil, we forgo any opportunity to create significant change. Yes, what happened yesterday was unnecessary. And yes, it was senseless. But it did not come from nothing. We are strong, but we are certainly not perfect. And that's okay. The moment we assume we are perfect is the moment we stop moving forward. And perhaps this is our greatest quality as a nation. We move forward. And move forward we will. But for now, let's take a moment of reflection. And above all else, let's thank our men and women in uniform, those in Ottawa and those in the rest of the country. Let us thank those who responded to the call yesterday and also those who respond to countless calls every day. And to Corporal Nathan Cirillo, at ease, you have made us proud. While the story of a soldier dying at the foot of the National War Memorial does fit somewhere into a grand romantic narrative, let it suffice to say that a good man died yesterday, and he will be missed. For the rest of us Canadians, let us come together. Let us form a new resolve, and let us learn from this.
Thank you to Konstantin Prodanovich for that amazing tribute. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM.
FM Vancouver Reloaded, playing your favorite tunes and mouth-humping your ear holes full of voice talk. Yeah, we do that.
Welcome back to News 101. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca. Broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory, here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
For our next segment on the show, we have a news report on the upcoming municipal election. Vancouver's civil election will be held on November 15th with 8 days of advance voting. Voters will choose from 119 candidates to elect the mayor, 10 council members for Vancouver City Council, 7 park board commissioners for the Vancouver Board of Parks and Recreation, and 9 school trustees for the Vancouver School Board. Voters will also be able to decide on whether to authorize the city to borrow a specific amount of money for major projects. Key electoral issues include affordable housing in Vancouver, crime in Surrey, and transportation in outlying suburbs. According to a poll by Insights West, 67% of people in Vancouver would like to see better people choose to seek public office, with 83% of adults surveyed in Maple Ridge Pitt Meadows saying they see a need for change at City Hall. Earlier this year, the provincial government implemented reforms for civic elections that will see a change in municipal politicians running for office from 3 to 4 years. This means winners of the upcoming election will hold on to their seats until late 2018. There are 4 key mayoral candidates. Vancouver's current mayor, Greg Robertson, is seeking re-election with the Vision Vancouver Party. He is also the co-founder of Happy Planet, an organic juice company. Vision Vancouver dominated the 2011 municipal election as all of their city council, park board, and school board candidates were elected. Their platform includes a commitment to better transit and the environment, with the goal of making Vancouver the greenest city in the world. Another top priority of their campaign is affordable housing and homelessness. As well, Vision is committed to inclusivity, with a commitment to invest in childcare, making new buildings age-friendly, supporting public schools and the LGBTQ community, as well as expanding access to community centers. They also support arts and culture and a growing economy. NPA's mayoral candidate is journalist Kirk Lapointe. He has worked as a senior editor at the Vancouver Sun, CTV, the National Post, and the Canadian Press, as well as an adjunct professor at UBC's Graduate School of Journalism. The NPA's commitments include the hiring and fostering of professional, experienced civic management at every level in the City of Vancouver. They also pledged to prudently manage the city's budget and support the economy by growing business, promoting innovation, and embracing entrepreneurship. NPA plans to engage neighborhoods and listen to citizens' opinions regarding development. They also promise to develop and enhance the transportation system, support environmental policies, and the public school system. Mina Wong is the mayoral candidate for COPE. She is an activist who moved to Canada from China when she was 19 years old and has previously worked for the federal NDP party. If Wong is elected, she will be the first woman and first person of Chinese descent to become Vancouver's mayor. COPE intends to prioritize education by providing funding for smaller class sizes for elementary and secondary schools. COPE is also committed to supporting diversity. They aim to change the provincial education funding model to prioritize public education. They plan to create affordable housing by establishing a Vancouver Housing Authority and work to build quality social housing in the downtown east side. As well, they propose an amendment to the Vancouver Charter to set a municipal minimum wage of $15 per hour for the City of Vancouver. Furthermore, they plan to extend park space by creating 1.1 hectare of new park space per 1,000 new residents and upgrade community and recreation center facilities. Finally, Bob Casting is a Vancouver-based lawyer who is running as an independent candidate. He currently practices estate litigation, administrative law, and civil litigation. He is representing the False Creek Residents Association and their ongoing battle with the city and Concord Pacific over the building of a park near the seawall. He wants to bring the focus back to Vancouver neighborhoods as he believes that Vision Vancouver and the NPA are too involved with big developers. That is your briefing on the mayoral candidates for the upcoming election. For more information, you can visit the party websites.
Up next on the program, we have an interview with Nicole Markwick, a grad student at UBC School of Population and Public Health, about the ongoing crisis in West Africa. News correspondent Morgan Yee spoke with her this morning.
My name is Nicole Markwick, and I'm a Master's of Public Health student at the School of Population and Public Health at UBC.
So first of all, I just want to discuss the flash mob that you and your colleagues organized a few weeks ago. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Sure. So this was, towards the end of September, and it was 3 events that were run at UBC, at the University of Guelph in Ontario, and then also in Ontario at McMaster University. And students came together to essentially try and raise a little bit of a fuss about the Ebola outbreak in West Africa, and in particular about the lack of international response to it. So the event kind of took an interesting and controversial sort of approach by getting students to dress up either as doctors, medical personnel, or as a bowler if they wanted to try their best at putting that into some form of visual representation, and run across campus. And the reason why it was controversial was because there wasn't a huge amount of educational component to it. It was to make a splash and to get people talking about it, because we felt that conversation wasn't really happening.
And the UBC did do some coverage of that, correct?
Yes.
And so did you feel like that did get the media coverage that you were looking for?
Definitely. And there was both positive and negative coverage, for sure. And as there rightly should have been. So it was a conversation that was started on campus and also in the Greater Vancouver community, which was kind of nice.
And what aspects of that conversation were you really looking for?
Well, at that point, what had happened was that there were scientists across Canada and across the globe who had been saying, you know, this is speeding up. This is an epidemic. We know how these work. We need to be responding now, because the impact of what we're going to do now is going to have such a greater impact than if we decide to do this in a month or 2 months' time. This was happening, this conversation, to some extent in newspaper and that kind of thing. But what we weren't seeing was the leaders of our international community, and in particular in Canada, responding in any sort of meaningful way. There were small contributions here and there, but nothing that sort of where leaders stood up and said, this is an issue, we recognize that this is an issue for a variety of reasons, and it needs to have a response that is of the same scope as the actual issue.
Now, I was reading a CBC article, and there's a couple petitions out there that are asking for the international community to view this as a natural disaster versus just an outbreak of a virus. Do you feel like that would be a way to get the international community really moving on providing the aid?
In many ways, yes. And you'll actually see, the UN, for example, has put together its first ever mission for a public health issue, and it's for those same reasons. This is an issue that requires immediate response, and one of the key things is that it doesn't just need money, it needs people on the ground, and it needs resources on the ground. In that way, it's very much analogous to natural disaster. So you have things like in Canada, we have our disaster assistance response team, DART, which we send out to typhoons or hurricanes, this type of thing. And that's because they recognize that there's not a great amount of capacity once something has rolled through in terms of medical response. So we need to send that, we need to provide that, and it needs to be quick and effective. And that's exactly what we need with this Ebola outbreak. So yes, I think it makes a lot of sense to treat it in a very similar way.
And how much has Canada been sending over in terms of personnel?
In terms of personnel specifically? Very little. In fact, Cuba is the one that's been leading the sort of the personnel response. Yeah,
really?
Which is a bit of a surprise to some people. But they've actually done this quite well. They're stepping into this humanitarian role that historically Canada kind of had, but is not really doing so much these days. But they've already sent over almost 250 personnel, medical personnel, and are training another sort of 450 or so. So they're the ones who are leading in the personnel response. Canada's response to this point has been largely sort of financial commitments. We've also sent some protective gear and vaccine. They've committed experimental vaccine dosages. But the really, really key thing to remember here is that most of this is just promises and commitments. And that doesn't make any difference to the health workers or the patients on the ground. In fact, so last Friday, I think it was Friday, Rona Ambrose, our health minister, committed another $30 million to the Ebola response for Canada.
Did she set a timeline for that?
No, I haven't seen any timeline comments about that. What was really interesting was that another comment that she made at that time was to acknowledge that of the $35 million that had previously been committed towards the Ebola response, only $5 million last Friday had actually been spent. So what we're seeing here is that major discrepancy between what has been committed in these promises that governments are putting out and what's actually making it to the response on the ground. And that's the incredible gap that's causing so many problems.
Now, there's other issues in these countries, not just with Ebola, but also with food scarcity and people being taken into these isolation centers when they don't actually have Ebola and then contracting it there. What do you think that Canada could do in terms of helping with these sorts of issues or associated issues?
Well, there are two such separate things that you brought up there, so maybe I'll address them separately. You talked about food scarcity, and there's no question that we're seeing rising food insecurity in these countries, in particular Sierra Leone, Guinea, and Liberia. And that is largely as a result of fear and the actual outbreak that's there. People aren't going out to the farms because they're scared of what's going to happen if they touch other people, so production's not happening. trade routes, all these kind of things are disrupted, so we're seeing food costs rising significantly. Staples are going up 20 to like 150% in the cost. And actually USAID's famine warning system is warning that by January we may have over a million people who are in need of emergency food aid in those countries. So that's directly tied to the actual Ebola response. If we were able to help contain this particular virus in the outbreak, that would not happen quite directly. The other thing that you commented on was people being brought into isolation wards and contracting things. Unfortunately, because of the incredible sort of spread of this particular virus, there's going to be a little bit of that type of thing happening where you have to play it on the safe side and put people into isolation if they are showing signs of Ebola. But what is really key there is that if there was the personnel on the ground to be making those isolation or to have those isolation wards functioning properly, we would be able to separate cases from suspected cases from people who you just want to keep under surveillance. We don't have that capacity. We don't even have enough beds for the confirmed cases. If we did, this would be a completely different scenario.
Now, we're talking about things that are just happening in West Africa, but there's also been several cases of people coming back from Africa, particularly in the United States, and there's been a lot of media attention to those cases and what Canada and the States have been doing to try to prepare and how their response has been perhaps less than satisfactory. But do you feel like this sort of intense focus on what's happening on the ground in Western nations is going to detract from how much the public is willing to support sending aid over to Africa?
In many ways, I think it might actually work in the other direction. The unfortunate reality of Ebola is that this is a hugely political health issue. It's taking place in a part of the world that has been and continues to be disenfranchised. And the focus of a huge amount of stigma. And so it's only when Ebola sort of raises its head in Western nations, inside our borders and inside our own healthcare systems, that people start to react. And unfortunately, it's been with large amounts of hysteria and things like that, but it has helped to raise the profile enough to spur some reaction from the governments in these countries. So I think perhaps in many ways bringing it, no pun intended, closer to home, means that we will actually see a stronger response as opposed to being able to relegate it to an area out of sight, out of mind.
So you're not worried that there's going to be a protectionist sort of view about this, where it's, that's their thing, let's deal with what we've got here?
Well, the ramifications of something like this are massive and wide-ranging. And in terms of protectionism and those kind of approaches, sure, it's almost certainly going to have responses along those lines. You've already seen, in the States in particular, people getting very up in arms about immigration and stuff like this, right? Scared of what's coming from other places in the world as people travel. So I'm sure there will be ramifications in that area. In terms of Ebola specifically and the treatment of Ebola and the outbreak, the response there will probably benefit, for lack of a better word, from having it a bit more, as I said, close to home.
And I guess my last question for you is, how much of an actual risk is there for Western nations of an Ebola outbreak becoming uncontainable?
Very little. We have really strong public health systems. Ebola is not a surprise. It's been since April that it's been a declared sort of public health threat globally. We're on high alert, we have plans, and we have the capacity, and that's the key thing that differentiates Western nations from Guinea, from Sierra Leone, and from Liberia. We have the ability to put people into isolation wards, to keep them separate. We know what we need to do and what equipment we need to use, and we have it available to us. So it's not really a key worry for us in Canada.
Well, thank you very much, Nicole.
Thank you, Morgan Yee, for that piece. Our next segment, we have news correspondents Rohit Joseph and Konstantin Prodanovich with part two of our coverage of UBC's proposed tuition and residence fee increases.
Last week, we did a story on the proposed tuition increases at UBC. In case you are just joining us on this issue, a few weeks ago, UBC administrators approached the student union to unveil a plan to increase international tuition by 10% and to hike residence costs by 20%, respectively. The new proposal is based on a need to invest in, quote, academic excellence. It is currently in a 30-day consultation process,
in which the administration will hear from student leadership and the general student population alike. In our show last week, we spoke with Ann Kessler, VP Academic from the AMS. Here is a clip from that interview.
Well, I think our first strategy is to really make sure that students know what's going on. I think we have as much power as we are given by students, and I think the more that students know about it and the more that students go to the town halls, make sure that the administration really officially, through their own means, knows that students are opposed to this, I think that's really important. So making sure that they know that the town halls are happening, that they know that they have the opportunity to have their voice heard, I think that's super important.
This week, UBC students held a general assembly at which they solidified their grievances and decided how they would take action. We decided to gather some student perspectives on the issue. Here are those voices.
All right, I'm here with a student from UBC right now. I'll let her introduce herself.
Hi there, my name's Ilana Schechter, and I'm a student at University of British Columbia.
And are you an international student or living on campus?
I'm actually a domestic student living off campus.
Interesting. And why are you opposed to the tuition increase as well as the residence increase that UBC has proposed?
Well, in general, I think it shows a really troubling trend in which direction the university is going in. So it seems like the only thing that they're starting to care about is really trying to invest as much money into quote-unquote research. And research is really a euphemism for treating the university as a corporation and not as a place of public education. Because of that, even though I'm a domestic student, I live off campus, so technically these fees don't really affect me, quote-unquote. Of course, they do affect me, and all of this is part of a larger philosophical direction that the university is going in that we need to challenge at all times.
And the reason I want to talk about this is because a lot of domestic students that I've spoken with think of this as being a problem that targets international students specifically, and a lot of them actually find that oddly legitimate because they think that international students should subsidize the education of domestic students. I don't think that, but I think this is a good way to draw attention to how these fees adversely affect not just international students, but domestic students as well.
What's your name?
Davis Janko.
Are you an international student?
I am not.
Are you living in res right now?
I am not.
What made you come up to the General Assembly today?
I want to support those who are international students and the people who are living in res.
What is it about supporting international students, even though you're not an international student? Why do you feel compelled to be out here?
I think that all of us are students. We all understand the burden of paying for tuition and for trying to stay afloat. Many of us are struggling with debt already coming into this. Mm-hmm. I feel like we're all in the same boat. It doesn't matter where we're from or what class, it doesn't matter. And so I think that in order for us to make a change, we all have to stick together.
Right. So it's an affordability issue for us, at least.
I think absolutely it's an affordability issue and an issue of power within the school system, the university system. And so if it's just the international students who are the ones who are affected who are trying to resist, and let's say they're a minority, and the rest of us just stand by, well, what's going to change? Nothing. Are we willing to let students who are in our classes, who we are friends with, who we care about, just fall underneath, the steamroller that is the administration? No, we're all going to stand up together, and we're going to say we don't approve.
What's your name?
Janis Fetch.
Are you an international student?
Yes, I'm from Switzerland.
How are you involved with the General Assembly today?
I've been part of a group of concerned and very diverse students from different involvement groups in campus. We wanted to voice our opinion around it, and so we started to create more creative spaces around this issue for people to come out and voice their opinion around it as well and see how they can get engaged on campus.
Is there an affordability issue as far as international tuition is concerned, as is?
Yes, it very much is. We're paying $2,300 per course. That is already an insane amount of money for a student to come up with. And thinking about tuition increases, that would just destroy most students' bank accounts. We already work so hard to be able to afford it now. I can't think of a future student being able to afford this if it's even further increased.
What kind of a turnout would you like to see as far as students are concerned at these General Assemblies?
General Assembly is one of the places where we also have a protest coming up. A lot of students don't understand yet that they think it's only for incoming international students. They think the residence fee increases are only for 8 months. People who only have an 8-month contract. But really all of this concerns all of us, because any increase has precedence for any other increases as well, not just here at UBC, but also other universities, because UBC is seen as kind of the big brother of all the other universities in this province. So I think all students on campus and even off campus should be engaged in this, because it will concern all of them in some way in the future. And if they can get through with this increase, what happens in the future if we don't speak up?
What's your name?
Augustine.
Are you an international student?
Yes, I am.
What made you come out to the General Assembly today?
I came because I think every voice needs to be heard from the university, and that's something that is lacking until now.
Do you find that you have... Is there an affordability issue as far as being an international student on this campus?
Obviously, I come from France, and obviously tuition fees here are big... Well, very different from what we're used to, and I do think that education should be affordable to everyone.
What's the consensus among international students, at least from the ones that you know, as far as these tuition hikes?
Oh, well, the people I know are mostly against it mm-hmm. and support the initiative.
What kind of a student base would you like to see here at the General Assembly trying to fight these increases?
Oh, I think it's something that concerns everyone, both international and non-international, and students should be united as a group to make their voice heard by the university.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Students also hosted open spaces in which they discussed strategies through which to deal with the tuition increases and residence increases.
So what we're going to do today is called an open space. An open space is a kind of method for facilitating large groups. So we're going to have, if you have something that you really want to talk about and you really want to come up with an answer for, something like, how are we going to address the needs of international students? How are we going to address the needs of students who are coming from rural parts of BC? If you want to lead a workshop on that issue, write your question on a piece of paper and say, I want to meet, and then you pick a space.
I definitely learned a lot from my experience in one of the General Assembly's open spaces. Everyone was able to voice their perspectives and concerns with the issues at hand. It was good to see domestic students in solidarity with international students, finding ways in which to bridge gaps and collaborate with one another. It was also great to hear what RAs, resident advisors, had to say about the issues. RAs are left in a tricky position. They have to navigate between helping out students who may have financial difficulties and are emotionally stressed by the impending tuition and residence fee increases, while at the same time having to make sure that they do not criticize their very own employers who they work for. Overall, the General Assembly provided a productive environment for students to deliberate on how to organize themselves, as well as coming up with tangible ways to resolve their grievances with tuition increases. However, the turnout at the General Assembly, which may be numbered at 100 or 150 at the most, was still paltry when we realized just how many students will be affected by the tuition and residence fee increases. UBC houses more than 9,000 students, and nearly 1 in 5 of all of our students on campus at UBC are international. I believe that the student body needs to mobilize in greater numbers and with greater conviction for even a chance at convincing the administration at UBC to put a stop to their proposed fee increases.
Thank you to Rohit Joseph and Konstantin Prodanovich for that piece.
earlier in today's broadcast, there were a few errors with our headlines. Here are this week's updated local and national headlines. In local news, the province continues to talk about gambling on ferries. BC Transportation Minister Todd Stone recently returned to the topic of installing slot machines and other gambling opportunities on BC ferries. In a recent comment, Stone said that, quote, discussions continue, and that they're, quote, still working their way through all the details of what that project could look like. The proposal was initially announced in November of last year, without the consultation of the Ministry of Finance or the BC Lotteries Corporation, which regulate and manage the province's gambling industry. In the original announcement, the Ministry of Transportation and BC Ferries said that they would start by putting slot machines on the Schwartz Bay to Tawasin route, though nothing has been done in the years since. NDP critic for transportation, Claire Trevena, was surprised by Stone's comment, saying that she, quote, thought it had been ruled out, or had at least gone to the back burner. Trevena was skeptical, saying that the minister doesn't seem to understand what he's doing. Quote, isn't it know your limit and stay within it? I think he's well beyond his limit. Documents obtained through Freedom of Information by the Tai'i show that as many as 5 routes are being considered for gambling machines.
Vancouver coal exporting facility still contested as more municipalities weigh in. The legal fight surrounding the construction of a new coal exporting facility continues, with residents and environmental groups facing off against the Vancouver-Fraser Port Authority. The court case has been joined by the City of New Westminster and the City of Surrey, with both municipalities issuing statements that they would seek intervener status in the case. Last month, EcoJustice filed an application in federal court seeking a judicial review of the Port Authority decision to permit the Fraser-Surrey Docks direct transfer coal facility to proceed. Lawyer Karen Campbell of the environmental charity EcoJustice said that the statements were, quote, incredibly supportive. EcoJustice is representing 2 environmental groups and some concerned Surrey residents in the case, though a hearing date has not yet been set.
In national news, radio host Gian Gomeshi is going to take a hiatus from his show Q and on CBC. CBC spokesman Chuck Thompson confirmed today that radio host and co-creator of the Q Cultural Affairs radio show, Gian Gomeshi, will be leaving for a, quote, undetermined amount of time to deal with, quote, personal issues. Q is a daily national talk show on CBC Radio 1, launched in 2007, and is currently syndicated in the United States, broadcasted on over 180 NPR and PRI stations. In a Globe and Mail piece from earlier this month, Gomeshi wrote that his heart was, quote, broken over the recent death of his father. The radio personality tweeted shortly after the announcement, thanking his listeners for their support and saying that he's okay. We here at News 101 would like to wish Gomeshi well and hope that it won't be long before we hear from him again. And that's our show for today, October 24th. Today's newscast was brought to you by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments on our website, citr.ca/news. For more independent news, join us next Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Rohith Joseph.
And I'm Emily Blake. Today's show was produced by Alberto Montilla. From the entire news team at CITR, thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Stranded, right here on CITR 101.9 FM.